President Trump's goal of defunding Planned Parenthood is likely to be reflected in the new version of the health care bill that Senate Republicans are preparing to release later today. Birthright, a War Story, a new documentary written by Lucina Fisher and Sivia Tamarkin, who also directed, follows the stories of women whose lives have already been directly affected by legislation supported by the anti-abortion movement. It opens tomorrow at the Village East Theater, and I'm very pleased it has brought Lucina Fisher and Sivia Tamarkin to our show. Welcome.
Thank you. We're so happy to be here.
How did the two of you start working together on this documentary? Was there any personal connection?
No, on the heels of the Hobby Lobby case back in June of 2014, when the Supreme Court ruled that a private employer could, of course, exclude coverage of contraceptives for employees, I was just outraged. I mean, I was part of the generation that fought to have reproductive rights and reproductive freedoms, and we assumed that was accomplished. And so I was just outraged at that decision. I couldn't understand how that had happened and decided that it was important to investigate it. So I called Lucina, who is a longtime friend and former colleague, and we decided to do this documentary.
Were you surprised that some of the stories you uncovered were not simply about the problems some women around the country have faced when they sought an abortion?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it wasn't that we were surprised. We sought out those stories because really what we wanted to show is that the legislation that has grown out of the opposition's attempt to erode Roe and get rid of Roe has manifested in so many different ways and affected women in a myriad of ways that have nothing absolutely to do with abortion.
What happened when Danielle Deaver went to the hospital because she had gone into early labor in Nebraska?
Right. Oh, well, that's an amazing story and so tragic because here is a couple who really wanted this child. It was their second child they were expecting. She went into premature labor at 22 weeks and the baby stopped developing, essentially. And she turned to her doctor to get the labor induced so that she could deliver the baby and they could say goodbye as a family to this child they wanted so badly. Unfortunately, in Nebraska, a law had just passed weeks before that banned any abortion after 20 weeks. Of course, the Deavers did not think this was an abortion.
Made it illegal to do an elective delivery of a baby. Is that the same thing as abortion,
well,
Sivia?
It was a law that precluded the forced induction of a fetus.
Now, did this decision, the doctors obviously couldn't do the procedure because they would have gone to jail, did that put the Danielle Deaver into danger?
It put her in extreme danger. Her temperature went up, her body was infected because the water bag had broken, so this was sepsis beginning to run throughout her whole body. Her life was definitely at risk.
And the baby was going to be born without arms and legs, I think you
said?
Well,
no, just was like a 10% chance that this baby would survive. And, of course, the lungs stopped developing at 22 weeks when she went into premature labor. So
this was a non-viable fetus that would not have survived. The chances, I believe, were less than 1, 2% that this child would have survived.
Who determines whether a fetus is viable?
Right. This is the question, isn't it?
Is the definition the same in each state?
Well, the Supreme Court defined it at 26 weeks, viability at 26 weeks in the Roe versus Wade case. And since then, states have been trying to slide that backwards.
24 weeks.
Mm-hmm. 20, and in a number of states now, they're trying to pass restrictive laws at 20 weeks, and including the state of Ohio, though the bill was defeated, they tried to pass a fetal heartbeat bill, meant it's six weeks. Once there's a heartbeat, that the fetus was viable. And the tragedy of that is most women don't even know they're pregnant at 6 weeks.
Now, if Danielle Deaver had lived in another state other than Nebraska, would she have faced a similar problem? Is this unique to Nebraska?
Nebraska was the first.
The first.
Nebraska was the first state, and this law had passed just prior to her experience.
My guests are Lucina Fisher and Sivia Tamarkin. Their film, Birthright, A War Story, opens this Friday, the day after, tomorrow. At the Village East Theater. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Let's talk a bit about Roe v. Wade. The Supreme Court argued that under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, women have the right to access to safe and legal abortion. So what's happened in the 40 years since?
Well, what has happened is that immediately after that decision came down, opponents of abortion began to organize, began to mobilize, and very strategically mapped out a battle plan and began to build a machine to overturn that law.
But 22 years after Roe v. Wade, 1995, Republicans were evenly divided on the issue. 49% supported the legality of abortion. 48% thought it was illegal, should be illegal. But in latest polls, Republicans say abortion should be illegal in all or most cases by a wide margin, 65% to 34%. When did opposition to abortion become a basic part of the Republican Party's platform?
Well, it goes all the way back to the 1980s with Ronald Reagan. Mm-hmm. Right to Life movement decided that they needed to move into the political arena in order to accomplish their goals. And so there was an alliance forged between the moral majority and Catholics and the Republican Party. It served the needs of the party, which brought resources and population into the Republican tent. And the movement began to see opportunity, and then there was payback for all the legislators that they helped elect into office.
Lucina, what happened in the Planned Parenthood versus Casey case?
Right. In that case, all these laws that were sort of trying to restrict access, the Supreme Court at that point said you cannot put an undue burden on women and their right to access abortion. Of course, they didn't quite define what undue burden was, and so they kind of left the door open. And since then, that door has been widening ever since.
Undue burden does not mean states like Louisiana, where there are three clinics that survive and are struggling to survive because of the laws?
It's incredible to me that there are only three clinics. And if you look at Louisiana, you see that HIV rates have risen there, STD rates. You know, people go to these clinics for so much more than abortion care, which is what, you know, the legislatures sort of get up in arms about. And so I think, yes, these are undue burdens, and we show that in the film, too, with one of our women that we talked to, Jenny Lynn McCormick in Idaho. She couldn't access the care she needed because a clinic was way too far away. It was too expensive for her.
Then there are other ways of changing things. Texas cut funding to family planning clinics, and Michigan's Insurance Opt-Out Act prevents insurance companies from paying for abortions even in cases of incest or rape.
It's awful, some of these laws. I mean, they're really cruel if you think about it.
But didn't the Supreme Court rule on the right to contraception? You mentioned contraception earlier. In 1965 in Griswold versus Connecticut, when and why did the use of contraception become a part of the anti-abortion discussion?
Very interesting, because originally there was total agreement even within the Republican Party on the need for family planning and contraception. President Bush 41, H.W. Bush, had sponsored family planning legislation in Title X when he was still in Congress. In fact, his father was on the original board of Planned Parenthood. And as the line began to move closer and closer toward trying to define what is an abortion, there was a number, there were a number of junk science, if you will, reports that claimed that contraceptives were what they call abortifacients, forms of abortion, because an IUD or the pill both prevent the fertilized egg from traveling up the birth canal and implanting into the uterus. So they call those forms of abortion.
Wouldn't using contraception mean avoiding unwanted pregnancies and as a result, lower abortion rates?
Absolutely, and it's been shown to be the case. So what's so interesting is that we're at a time where you have the opposition to both contraception and abortion care. So what choices are women left with? What is the real motivation here? And that's what we try to uncover in our film.
Is contraception opposed mostly on religious grounds?
Yes.
Don't some opponents argue also that, you mentioned pseudoscience, that it can cause all sorts of health issues?
They do. They try to say that what they are doing is protecting the woman. And they are claiming that there are all sorts of side effects, potential side effects. And most of the medical community does not agree with that. The American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology does not agree with that. The American Cancer Association does not agree with that.
What's awful, though, is that you have somebody in the White House right now who's advising the president saying that contraceptives, the pill in particular, is a health hazard for women. And that's just simply not true.
What did she say it does?
That it causes a greater incidence of cancers. And that's just
And they also say it will cause infertility in the future.
Right, right.
But do evangelicals who oppose abortion also oppose contraception?
Well, it's certainly become part of the anti-abortion movement philosophy. So those who do believe that life begins, as they say, at conception, that the fertilized egg is a human being, oppose contraception. Certain forms. They don't oppose condoms, but they do oppose those methods of contraception that interfere with this fertilized egg being implanted in the womb.
Right.
We'll take a little break and come back with more. I want to talk about your conversation with Carol Tobias, the current president of National Right to Life, and other things. My guests are Sivia Tamarkin and Lucina Fisher, whose film Birthright, A War Story opens tomorrow at the Village East Theater. Stay with us for more. And we are back with the two creators of a film called Birthright, A War Story. We have here Lucina Fisher and Sivia Tamarkin. The film opens tomorrow at the Village East Theater. You spoke with Carol Tobias, the current president of the National Right to Life Organization. Does she say that the pro-life movement is grounded in religious beliefs?
Yes, I interviewed her, and she certainly says that it's based on the religious belief that life begins at conception, and that every life is precious, and that they want to preserve the humanity and the personhood of the fetus.
Well, they with other religious issues, until recently, in fact, it's generally been decided that it's perfectly okay for you to observe to carry on your religious beliefs, but not necessarily to impose them on others. Is there an exception here?
Well, that's the most interesting part of it, that there's an exception when it comes to religious beliefs, to medical decision-making, to bodily autonomy, to the bodily integrity. The exception is a woman's reproductive organs. I mean, no other situation can an individual be forced to undergo medical procedures without their permission, can have their control over their bodily functions.
How does National Right to Life reach the public, especially young people?
Oh, well, we show that in the film, that they've really been grooming young people now for decades, and they have these camps, which was one thing we showed in the film that many people were surprised by. These are youth camps for young people to come learn about the fight against abortion and how to further the pro-life agenda, and to talk about it with their classmates and go back to their communities. And these are kids who are sort of the rising stars of politics of tomorrow.
And is the politics mostly on the local level?
It's local. It's at the school boards. It's in the state legislatures. It's in towns and cities. I mean, that's the thing, that this opposition movement has infiltrated every aspect of politics.
A listener called in to ask if these abortion laws only apply to people who depend on public finance. Can people with money get around them?
People with money have always gotten around them, going back to the 19th century, to the turn of the 20th century. Disproportionately, women who are poor, women of color, women who rely on Medicaid are certainly affected. But other women are affected as well. They're affected because, as in Danielle Deaver's case, you know, her pregnancy turned non-viable after the cutoff date.
Right. She pointed out, here I am, this educated woman with a middle class family. I have a great job. I have private insurance. I never expected this to happen to me, to have my doctor's hands tied and to be caught up in this fight.
You cite a number of personal cases. One involves Jenny Lynn McCormick. Where was she living when she became pregnant for the third time?
She was in Idaho, and Idaho had its own early version of what we call the trap laws, laws that restrict the procedure surrounding an abortion, therefore making it de facto inaccessible. And Jenny Lynn had discovered her pregnancy late in term. She had irregular menstrual cycles, so it didn't disturb her when she missed several. And at that point, the state of Idaho had a law that said terminations in the second trimester must be performed by physicians, must be performed under hospital settings. And she didn't have the funding for that, and she tried to go to find a clinic that would do it in Idaho. There were none. She tried to get to Salt Lake City. The cost was prohibitive.
So she decided to perform it on herself, but through the use of pills?
Yes. She went online with her sister, and they ordered misoprostol.
And how did the police find out about it?
She essentially told a friend, and the friend, I think it was a relative of the friend, called the police, and the police showed up at her door. I believe she said there were three officers, and they asked her if she had an unlawful miscarriage. And she's like, an unlawful miscarriage? Wouldn't that be my business? Women miscarry all the time. But they said, not necessarily. This could be illegal, and they arrested her.
Charged with abortion? Did she go to jail?
She did not serve time in jail. She was able to, when she understood what was happening, she did turn herself in, and she posted bond, and her hearing was extended. And at one point, the prosecutor dropped the charges.
What happened to Katie Dorovitz when she gave birth to her son? The doctors found traces of marijuana in the baby's blood?
It wasn't even in the baby's blood. It was actually in Katie's blood. The baby was born completely healthy. Unbeknownst to her, the hospital drug tested her blood and found traces of marijuana, which she had been using in a medicinal way. She's somebody who suffers from epilepsy. And so she was using the cannabis to medicate her seizures and stop them during pregnancy. She was actually afraid that the epilepsy medication she had been taking previously and had caused a previous miscarriage would cause her to lose this baby that she so desperately wanted.
How often are women in the United States incarcerated because drugs were found in their blood or their newborn's blood?
Well, at the time that we were doing this documentary, we looked at Alabama in particular, and there were over 500 women who had been arrested under their chemical endangerment statute. And this chemical endangerment law had actually been instituted to fight meth labs, these homemade meth labs in people's homes. And the children who were exposed to those chemicals in the home. Well, some prosecutors got a little creative, if you will, and decided that a mother's womb had become the new home. And
then they expanded it beyond methamphetamine.
Absolutely. I mean, as you can see in the film, there's a woman who took half a Valium some weeks before. We're saying half now, not even a whole one. She had never taken any drugs throughout the pregnancy, but it showed up in the drug screen after she'd given birth. And 6 weeks after she'd given birth, the police show up at her job and arrest her for chemical endangerment of a child.
What happens when a woman tries to be sterilized in Nebraska or South Carolina? Sterilization would prevent the formation of a fetus.
It depends where they go for this. If it is a Catholic facility, for example, then a tubal ligation performed during the time of a C-section, which is the safest time to do it, may be prohibitive.
Prohibited because?
Because Catholic hospitals do not allow contraceptives. They do not allow, and tubal ligations is considered a form, I mean, the sterilization prevents pregnancy. They also do not allow vasectomies. They do not administer any type of contraceptives, whether they're IUDs or pills.
So this is a hospital-by-hospital decision? There are no laws involved?
This is under Catholic health care, operates under the guidelines set forth by the Conference of Catholic Bishops.
There you have the story of a Hasidic woman whose pleas were ignored by her doctors.
Well, her pleas were that she wanted to have a natural childbirth.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know why she had to even fight for that when they insisted on giving her a C-section.
Well, they insisted on giving her a C-section because her labor was taking quite a while. And though she says she was not given any indication that there were problems, and she had her birth doula with her, who also acknowledges that there was no indication of problems. But the doctors wanted to hurry her along. They wanted her to have a C-section. And the most significant thing about her case is that she did not have written consent. She did not sign anything, yet they whisked her down the operating room, performed the C-section against her will with her screaming and crying, and afterwards there was they cut her bladder. So you certainly have a case of
malpractice
perhaps. I know that she has a suit going on, but the real issue why we had the story included is that her bodily integrity was violated against her will. There's no other situation where physicians can impose a medical procedure. It had been her gallbladder. They could not have wheeled her in against her will.
So you began making this film with the idea of talking about contraception and abortion, and you discovered that there were many other situations where women had to fight for their rights and often lost?
Well, no. I did not want to do a film about abortion. I wanted to do a film predicated on all the restrictions that are placed on women's bodily integrity and bodily autonomy. I wanted to connect the dots and show that the fallout from this anti-abortion mentality can also victimize women who are against abortion.
Mm-hmm. A listener wants to know about what the National Abortion Rights League impact has been. Has their pushback been effective?
Well, I think that what has happened is that the abortion rights movement was really blindsided in many cases by the rapid onslaught of all these restrictions. I mean, since the midterm elections of 2010, when the Tea Party swept into power, 30% of the anti-abortion laws or the restrictive laws that have been passed, have been passed in the last 5-6 years.
Right.
So I think a lot of people were blindsided. They thought they won. They thought they had secured rights and privacy that would never be revoked.
But there are all sorts of other ways of slowing things down, imposing waiting periods, for example, having people shown sonograms of fetuses. And
Forced viewing of
sonograms. Exactly, and read all this verbiage that...
Does that have much of an impact?
I don't think so.
Well, it does. It does in terms of additional undue burden, because when you have a waiting period, if someone had, because of the shutdown of so many clinics in places like Texas, where people have to travel long distances, where people may have to spend the night in a hotel or motel, or in cases we've heard of women sleeping in their cars in order to come back to meet the standard of this 28 or 48 hour period, it does place an undue burden, and it's a hardship, and sometimes women can't afford that. They can't afford daycare, care for children that may be at home while they have this procedure.
Right. That was actually Jenny Lynn's case, but you know, ultimately she procured misoprostol to be able to perform it at home. And but it is true that there will be some women who will end up going through a pregnancy that they cannot afford to maintain or you know, bring another child into their family.
And ironically, a point that you had raised earlier is that because of all these bans on family planning and the shutdown of family planning clinics, those opportunities to access services are not being replaced, even though in the state of Texas, for example, when they declared they would no longer fund Planned Parenthood family planning clinics, the family planning services did not show up as an alternative, and therefore the pregnancy rate among teenagers surged and the abortion rate surged. Mm.
In the original Republican proposal for health care, there were a number of pre-existing conditions that apply here. Now, why are things that involve pregnancy considered pre-existing conditions?
Well, I'll tell you that, you know, I didn't realize when my doctor told me I had to have a third C-section that I could question that decision. But the fact that I'd had two previous C-sections was seen as a pre-existing condition. And it didn't occur to me that I could even question the doctor telling me this is the way it's going to be, there's no other choice, until I heard Renat's story and realized that I too felt I had been forced to do something I really would rather not have.
And why would the doctors do that? Is it just easier to do a C-section? Isn't natural childbirth the way it's been for a couple of million years?
Absolutely. But I think in this day and age, doctors are worried about liability. If they allow a labor to continue for too long, I think it's more expedient to do a C-section. And quite frankly, for patients who are on Medicaid, there's more remuneration for a C-section than there is for natural labor.
We're pretty much out of time, but where do you see all of this going?
Well, I think that, you know, we see this film as portending, you know, the real-life Handmaid's Tale. I think when you have government intrusion, banning contraception, banning abortion, limiting, as the Senate proposal does now, for health care, limiting maternity coverage and prenatal, you have no choice but for women to breed.
The film Birthright, A War Story, opens tomorrow at the Village East Theater, and there'll be all sorts of Q&As tomorrow at the 7:05 screening, then on Saturday after the 7:05 show, and on Sunday. For more information, go to our show page at wmyc.org/lopate. My great thanks to Lucina Fisher and Sevilla Tamarkin for being on our show to talk about the film.
Thank you for
having
us.
Thank you so much for your interest.